Hello and welcome to the Saxo Market Call. It's Thursday, 4th of February, 2021, and stocks making their huge comeback recently in the U.S. First couple days of this week, and were broadly okay yesterday. We saw some of the broad indices closing higher, but the most speculative end of the spectrum getting into a little bit of trouble and correcting after almost touching the all-time highs again. As you can see, the Nasdaq 100 on our slide two. Peter, was there anything else? It was a bit more of a mixed session in terms of the internals of the market yesterday, that you saw in yesterday's session.
Yeah, there was some great moves yesterday. So for once actually, so the comeback the past couple of four or five sessions has been driven by the bubble stocks. So the stocks that are already extremely expensive, and by that we mean enterprise value over sales of above 10 times, and that group has become quite big. But yesterday, as we show on slide three, you can see the green transformation, but also the commodity sector. I'll come back to the commodity sector in a few seconds because I think it's a nice link and lead into Altea's fixed income space. But staying with the green transformation, as you can see here on slide three, we're seeing a massive move this year as well in the EU carbon emission prices. This is the market that was modeled on the same structure that was put in place in the US to combat acid rains from heavy industrial production. So it's the same idea. The problem was that the big framework was introduced just before the financial crisis, basically, and with no mechanism to reduce supply of credits because they had never imagined that, who can imagine anything bad happening in the world, right? That industrial production would go down. And then what happened was that as you can see on the slide, that we had carbon emission prices going from 30 euros per ton of CO2 emissions to all the way down to 2 in 2013. And it has required two or three reforms since then to introduce the mechanism of actually reducing the supply of credit. And the supply of credit is being reduced by 1.5 to 1.7% per year, but this year it will be ramped up to a 2.2% reduction. And as you can see, the carbon prices are rising, and I think that is partly one of the most important indicators to have on your watch list if you are trading or investing for the long term in the green transformation basket or the the companies that are in that theme. Because as the prices go up here, it will incentivize companies to go more green, or maybe not, because John, we had that discussion, right? I mean, can EU do this in isolation? That's the big question.
That is a huge question because, as well, if you have these standards for your own economy and you're taxing via the carbon tax the types of production that there's, for example, here in Denmark, which is considered a very green place, there's a company that makes cement, and that's just a massively carbon-consuming industry. Does the production just cease entirely and we stop making cement? No, you just start importing your cement from somewhere else in the world where they don't have these expensive carbon emission prices. And what's then the purpose? Because the net effect on the climate is nil. You've just eliminated an industry from your country and put it in another country. So eventually, if they have to have if they want to have credibility, they would have to have some sort of trade tariffs. And this is could be a form of protectionism, which would be massively ironic because the EU is a massive exporter to the world. So to me, this whole scheme is self-defeating, at least economically, unless there's a way to transform the entire global economy onto the same platform.
Yeah, exactly. I would say, John, I mean, you can you would think that all the major countries in the world should sit around a table at the WTO, right? Because the irony is that you cannot have global trade when you have this environmental problem without having a global solution to it. I mean, you need to have a global price because otherwise, as you say, what we have done in the US and Europe is just shifting industries to Asia, and we'll just wash our hands and say, oh, we have become greener. But the CO2 emissions are just and pollution is just changing its geography. But it at the same time as it has shifted off the employment and in industrial jobs, which again is fueling a lot of the tensions that we're seeing in the western part of the world with the divergence in income and opportunities between different parts of the population. It's a very I think it's a very big story, and it has a lot of different narratives that are entangled. But so probably not for this. Maybe we should do a special podcast one day on this, John. But
Yeah, also
yeah.
exactly how, what kind of input price implications it creates for a specific company or a specific industry when you're talking about a carbon price. It just feels abstract. What's a carbon price at 38 mean versus a carbon price of 10 for the price of X, Y, or Z? But let's have that conversation another time. Actually, I want to jump to you, Altea, because I don't want to leave you hanging for too long, first of all, but also because we have some interesting thoughts today in the fixed income space. I'll get to the U.S. Yields in a moment. We saw some strong U.S. data yesterday, but I talked a little bit yesterday about a key the development that is that Mario Draghi is being tasked with forming a new government. Take us through your thoughts on that, the likelihood that he's going to be able to do that smoothly, I guess, and what it means for, well, not just Italian BTPs, but you as an Italian, what your thoughts are and what it could mean for the whole EU, maybe framework or Italy's position within the EU, etc.
Well, at this point of time, the market clearly is thinking that Mario Draghi is the person that is going to be able to take Italy forward, not only in terms of economic recovery, but also in terms of relationships with the European Union. But I think that the important fact here is that without any kind of political support, Draghi is a power. Less. So these days, when Draghi is reaching out to various political parties and trying to form a government, are crucial to understand what is going to be his overall power in at this point of time. And also, it's going to be very important in order to predict where Italian assets can go from here. So, John, you know that I always been positive on Italian BTPs. I always thought that the spread between BTP and the Bund would tighten in the long term. I think that with Draghi or without Draghi, this trend will continue. But with Draghi solidifying his position as prime minister, that trend could be accelerated. So in terms of spread between the 10 years BTP and the Bund, we can see it falling below 100 basis points in the near term. And on the long term, we will see the spread between the 30 years BTP and the Bund falling below 120 basis points. And the kind of gain that this can provide to bondholders, it's quite nice. We are talking between 2% up to 7-8% in a matter of weeks.
Those are the kind of returns that are hard to come by for anything fixed income related. So it's very interesting to see how the spread develops and what kind of weight Mario will have in or throwing his weight around in an EU context. He's certainly a more forceful personality in that way, having the ECB experience, etc. Let's go back, circle back, Peter, to the reflation talk you have here. We've got, got some interesting developments with especially the oil price, which to me is the number one inflation input heading to these levels up, getting close to $60 now in Brent. You've got some thoughts on reflation on slide four here.
Yeah, we mentioned it yesterday with the group of moves such as upside surprises across the board on inflation. We had another one yesterday on the Eurozone core inflation for January hitting 1.4% year over year, and that's I have to underscore that that's without the base effects coming in over the next couple of months as prices plummeted on the pandemic and the lockdowns around the world. So we have positive inflation surprises. We have rising commodity prices, especially energy prices. We have now also a rising long end of the U.S. yield curve. The 10-year is getting close to 1.15, so 1.15, and all of those. were indicating to me that the reflation trade is back, but we didn't see that in the commodity sector within equities yesterday, but sorry, 2 days ago. But then yesterday was one of the best performing parts. And I just flagging here on slide four, our basket. So you can sort of, view this as a little bit buffet, and you can choose the ones that you think are interesting or get inspired at least. I think it's potentially one of those. It looks difficult now to see how it could become something a multi-year theme, but I do actually think that if we are writing our narrative and I still personally think that with all the debt in the world, it is the only sensible end game for politicians is to, create inflation, devalue the fiat currencies around the world. So and in that inside that sits, as we have talked about, the massive success of the past 15 years of the digital economy, which I think have driven a huge underinvestment in the physical world. And you cannot have the digital world sits on top of a physical world that delivers all the goods needed to be sold via the, demand function of the digital economy, right? E-commerce, et cetera. So I feel confident that this reflation could become something over many years. And we just in the first inning of this. And you can see here on the small insert to the right-hand side of the slide on slide four, that's the Bloomberg commodity index. And you can see here we back now to basically the highest levels even in the months before the pandemic broke out. And it's a very strong uptrend. I wonder how much we can go up from here, but why not?
Well, why not indeed? And as well, I mean, we have two things going on over the last 24 hours. We had a couple more strong US data points. This in for January, which I think will prove to have been the peak month for the pandemic in the US by far, as we're seeing the numbers collapsing there. The ISM services out at 58.7, that was versus a sub 57 expected, and even an improvement on an already strong 57.2 in December. And keep in mind that these indices, you have to keep improving for a higher number. It means you're improving at a faster rate than what was already fast the previous month. And the employment index at the highest since the pandemic outbreak happened in the US at 55.2. ADP also beating there. So we've got this story of a lot of potentially pent-up savings ready to be flushed through the economy and or sloshing through the economy. And you have a potential stimulus on the way, where the noise is getting a little bit more promising on it being towards the higher end of expectations. Biden is looking to fast track that. It could be close to the 1.9 trillion originally designed, even if it doesn't include the minimum wage bits and pieces in there, because of some statements by one key vote in the Senate, at least the Democrat Joe Manchin. And then along that lines, what we're seeing is, and this is where I bring you back in, Althea. U.S. 30 years, we tend to focus on the 10-year a lot because, well, it's just a key benchmark. But the 30-year just popped to a new high for the cycle. You've got that on slide six. I think I'll let you talk a little bit about that. But I think it's one of the reasons, for example, although commodities are interesting, gold is a little bit lower because that means the real rates are popping up if the longer rates in the U.S. are allowed to head higher. What are your thoughts on this level here we're reaching? We're getting close to not that far away from 2% now in the 30-year.
Absolutely. This is in 30 years yields. This is the highest we have seen since last February. So it seems that yields are right now normalizing, right? Because they are not above what we have seen at the beginning of last year. However, John, I think that the point here is that money supply is incredibly high and the US yield curve is still lagging. So we must see some fast steepening fairly soon. And this means that this can provoke losses among bondholders. I just want to flag that yesterday the Treasury didn't change the planned issuance of longer-dated securities, which is going to happen at the quarterly debt auction of next week. If the Treasury was increasing long-term issuance, the sell-off that we would have seen on the 30 years Treasury yields would have been deeper. So obviously, there is a plenty of risk ahead for higher yields.
All right. And with the higher yields, we're seeing the dollar yen pulling higher as well. Although, if we look further back over the last many months, the U.S. long end of the yield curve has not been the greatest indicator for dollar yen. I had a discussion in my FX update yesterday. You can see that on analysis.saxo. And instead, I think what we should look at, I mean, U.S. rates will be one factor, and certainly as they're hitting new highs, they start to press against the yen, which is quite weak here. Also on commodities rising. I think there's three moving parts with the Japanese yen. It's a risk appetite in general, yields in general, and then credit spreads as part of the risk appetite, really. And you can see on slide five, I put this in my FX update yesterday as well, that the EM credit spreads have been a pretty good indicator for the direction of the yen. And one of the reasons it's so weak right now is we have commodities moving against the Japanese yen, because they're basically the commodity import bill is, and all their commodities are supplied from abroad. You can even see on a small chart on the right on slide five that when prices for oil were there above $100 for a sustained number of years, and the Japanese yen was really flying lower on the crazy expansion of the balance sheet by the Bank of Japan at the time, that we almost got to a negative current account balance for Japan, unheard of circumstances historically. So I think for the Japanese yen to have any chance at firming up, we would need for the, well, first of all, commodities to stop rising too quickly, but for there to be some risk off in something like EM credit, because that's where a lot of Japanese savings like to cluster for the carry implications on buying higher yielding bonds. We're stretching on a little bit here. It's a key Bank of England day. I think we've kind of discussed it thoroughly. It really is about whether they're going to go signal anything on negative interest rates intentions or not. Althea, just briefly, you and I had a discussion on negative yields, and you were saying that, well, it's already priced into the cutting rates. And I've only been looking at the next several Bank of England meetings. It's sort of a toss-up there. But given that, as you show on slide nine, that actually you've got negative rates on UK gilt paper out to three plus years, you would have to have negative rates, of course, for the policy or for the rate to be that low out there. So it's going to be a huge signal for sterling. And I think sterling will be extremely reactive either way. I think it's very hard to see a middle ground where they sort of signal maybe negative interest rates, but not just now. But I suppose you're looking towards the belly of the curve as well, or the front end of the curve more than the long end for what the reactions will be.
The key point here is that negative rates are not totally priced in the front end of the yield curve, but yet they are negative, so they are partially priced in, just because investors are skeptical for the economy. So I think that the biggest takeaway that we can get out from the Bank of England meeting today is what are their economic forecasts, and it will be key to understand how the front end of the yield curve will position according to this new and revised forecast. But right now, it seems that the bond market is thinking that a rate cut is possible ahead.
All right. And you wonder how accurate their forecast can be. And they are particularly accurate, but especially in the case of being in total lockdown versus what the world looked like in 6 months. And we're getting maybe an inkling of that. Just briefly want to mention this. I was trying to find something on the UK COVID numbers, and I found an official site where in 2 weeks from January 19th to February 1st, and this is in a country that has this very, very highly contagious B117 variant of the COVID. And yes, that's they're in total lockdown, so maybe it's not spreading as well, but the hospitalizations have dropped 38% in 2 weeks, and that was up through February 1st. That is staggering, and it makes some sense if it's mostly the vulnerable that get sick and hospitalized anyway, and basically most of those have been vaccinated at this point or will be vaccinated soon. So we can certainly hope that that kind of number continues, and if it does, it'll allow an aggressive opening up. Peter, any last thoughts on earnings before we close it down?
No, not really. There is no real important earnings to mention really today. The only one we highlighted was Unilever, and they have already reported in European pre-session, and they had a small beat on the Q4 earnings, and otherwise a very stable guidance on organic growth. So pretty straightforward there for the biggest index component in the FTSE 100, Unilever there, but nothing else really to report.
All right. And on the macro calendar, Bank of England is front and center. Well, watching the weekly claims out of the US, if that is employment numbers are improving, would certainly expect that to improve rapidly as well. And then Australia, RBA, out talking again and publishing a monetary policy statement overnight ahead of the US payrolls numbers and labor market report tomorrow for January. That's it for today. Thanks for joining, and we'll be back tomorrow with the Saxo Market Call.